Hi, everyone. It's Dr. Goyal here, and you're listening to Peak Human Labs podcast. And today I have a very special guest, Dr. Habib, with me. Let me just give you a little quick bio on him. He's the author of Activate Your Vagus Nerve and Health, and host of the Health Upgrade podcast. He graduated as class valedictorian from the Canadian Memorial Chiropractic College in 2010 and went on to practice traditional chiropractic medicine for many years until he utilized the power of functional medicine to transform his own health. So I'd love to hear about that today. He's also the founder of Health Upgraded, which we'll be hearing about, an online functional health consulting clinic supporting optimal health by elevating the awareness and function of the vagus nerve. And so primarily this is where we've kind of reconnected at the conference, anti-aging conference, I don't know, 6 months ago. And I thought,
Looking
upon this booth on the vagus nerve, I was told, it's like, okay, that's very interesting. And then he was at the booth, and I'm like, wow. And then there was a great talk there, a great science-based talk. And I thought, let's just get you on this because this is something most people aren't talking about. We hear the traditional kind of stuff happening in functional medicine, but nobody's really talking about, you know, vagus nerve therapy. So let's get right into it. I'll put some web links in the show notes so people can hear that. But Navaz, maybe if you don't mind, let's call you that for the rest of the
episode. Yeah, I'm good with that.
Episode. Maybe just tell us a little bit about yourself. Like, how did you even, you're a chiropractor, but sorry, let me just close this off. How did you get involved in this whole space?
It's a great question.
Tell me about it.
It all started at chiropractic college, where a lot of the topics that we talk about is very kind of neuro-based and anatomy-based, understanding the anatomical structures of the body. Obviously, when you're a hands-on practitioner, you need to know the anatomy really, really well. And I've always been very anatomically focused and very driven by knowing the nervous system and how the nervous system works. As far back as high school, when I built a model of the brain for my grade 12 biology project, and I labeled it, I got like 100% on that. So the brain has always been something that I'm very curious about, very excited to hear about. The vagus nerve always kind of stuck out because it was a nerve that was different from any other nerve in the body. No other nerve has as many connections as the vagus nerve. And at the time, what seemed like as ambiguous amount of function as the vagus nerve has, and it was ambiguous to me, which kind of piqued my curiosity a long time ago with it. At the same time, while I was in chiropractic college, I weighed 250 pounds. I had high blood pressure. I was borderline diabetic. I was dealing with health issues that nobody in their 20s, let alone anybody in their 50s, 60s, 70s should be dealing with, right? Mm-hmm. And these health challenges were a struggle that I was trying to figure out how I was going to get through it. But I didn't fully understand what health meant. And that was where functional medicine really came in. My red pill moment was when a very chance encounter occurred with Sachin Patel. Sachin is my one of my mentors, the guy that brought me into the world of functional and really introduced me to understanding the concept of health, not being the absence of disease, but rather the production of optimal energy and function and human cellular processing to the level where you can be the best version of yourself. That red pill moment led to significant weight loss, significant improvement in my energy levels, what I'm capable of doing. And it was that moment when I had to kind of step away from the hands-on chiropractic care and really shift into the functional world because it made such a profound change in my life that I needed to share it with as many people as possible. And that's what brought me here. And then through that functional kind of world, I was trying to piece together what was the basic process by which we go from health to disease. Mm-hmm. And the more common avenue is inflammation, right? Inflammation is generally this basic underlying challenge that's ongoing, that when there is a lack of control of that inflammation, we go down this path towards disease and dysfunction. And we want to make sure that there is control. Inflammation in itself is not a bad thing. It's an important process. But the control of that inflammation is where that missing piece often is. So we need to know the sources of all these potential inflammatory challenges, which is what functional medicine is heavily rooted in, understanding the root cause of these problems. Mm-hmm. But what's that common avenue that leads to the lack of control? And that is where the vagus nerve really comes in and plays an important role. The vagus nerve is the controlling piece of the parasympathetic nervous system, mm-hmm. the rest and digest system as we know it. But more importantly, it is the controlling branch of the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway. That, for me, was a massive light bulb moment that said, this is the pathway. When this is broken down, when this is dysfunctional, inflammation control is gone.
And so were you learning this in chiropractic college? I'm just curious, or where did you actually learn this piece? Because again, even in medical school, we just learned the vagus nerves, innervating one of the few nerves that comes all the way down to the stomach or to your heart.
Yeah,
but we didn't know much more than that. This whole inflammation piece was really new to me.
Yeah, I was lucky enough to be going through school when the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway was being discovered. And because of my interest in it, when we learned about the vagus nerve, I was also concurrently kind of doing my own research and learning a little bit about the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway. This was the work of Kevin Tracy at the Feinstein Institute that really brought this to light. But it was not something that was in the curriculum by any means at that point.
Okay, perfect. And so then, yes, you basically stumbled upon the role of the vagus nerve as a major anti-inflammatory modulator, it sounds like.
That's exactly it. It's a modulator of inflammation within the body.
Right. And so just for our viewers who are not even familiar, a little bit more about just the vagus nerve, what other functions does it serve apart from, because they never see the inflammation.
Of course. I'll do a quick anatomy lesson on it. Yeah. It's the 10th cranial nerve. We have 12 pairs of cranial nerves that come out of the brainstem and primarily have the function of allowing us to sense things through our cranium, optic nerve, olfactory, etc. We have all of these very specific functions on the senses. The vagus nerve has a branch that initially, when it comes out from the brainstem, goes to the ear, which is really important to understand why auricular acupuncture and things like that work on that piece. That is the auricular branch. Okay. So one important piece, and that's something that's been around for thousands of years, right? Acupuncture has been done for thousands and thousands of years in TCM, and it was doing stimulation of the vagus nerve when they were hitting points like Shen Men in the ear. So an important branch. It then continues down in the neck, sends a branch to the pharyngeal and laryngeal muscles. So the muscles are at the back of the throat to maintain a good patent airway, and the muscles around the vocal cords. So we have pitch and tone in our voice through the laryngeal branches of the vagus nerve.
So do you think that the stress that we sometimes feel in our throat or changes in voice that happen with stress could be related to vagus nerve or impact?
Yeah, there absolutely is a risk of that occurring, absolutely. So something that I'm assessing when I'm speaking with a new client or new patient is their tone in their voice. Are they able to raise pitch and tone effectively? Can they go really, really low or really, really high without much issue? Are they very monotone in their speaking? Mm-hmm. Little things to kind of keep an eye out from a clinical perspective.
Interesting. Okay. Oh, sorry, I interrupted you.
Keep no going. Problem. As it passes down through the neck, it's actually going alongside the carotid artery and the jugular vein. Mm-hmm. So it's within this sheath called the carotid sheath. Shows you just how important this nerve is because it's literally sitting there with the blood vessels that bring blood to and from the brain. Mm-hmm. Kind of an important function. Goes down into the thorax, sends a branch to the heart, branches to the lungs, and continues coursing down. The right and the left will come together in the chest area, and they'll go down along the esophagus, innervating the esophagus, and going down to through the diaphragm to the stomach, small intestine, large intestine, kidneys, liver, gallbladder, pancreas, and indirectly to the spleen, which is a very important pathway on the cholinergic and the inflammatory pathway.
Oh, wow. Okay. I didn't realize that. So is there one side that's more important than the other?
No, they're both about the same. The only difference is the left side is containing about 150,000 fibers, 100 to 150,000 fibers. The right side is closer to a quarter million.
Quarter million.
Yeah.
Okay. Okay. So if you want to have an impact, are you, I know we're going to talk about stimulation of vagus nerve, but does it matter what side?
It actually has not been shown to be different side to side. And there was a recent study that came out with gastroparesis patients, and they found no difference left or right.
Mm-hmm. You know, I'm from my, again, when I, from my medical school training, we always learned that it was stimulation would activate the parasympathetic system. And so, you know, it might slow down the heart rate and,
this is always a thought process, a concern, right? We don't want to go into a state of bradycardia. We don't want to slow down the heart too much. That has never, ever happened with any of the research studies or any of the clinical applications of mm-hmm. electrical vagus nerve stim non-invasively.
Mm-hmm. You know, there's a, one of the first things I got, kind of got my understanding about the value of this was a device called a HeartMath. I don't know if
you've heard of this device. Big fan of HeartMath.
Yeah, heart coherence, where they're, I guess, working with breath and heart rate. So is this also some work on the vagus nerve, or how
yeah, it is, absolutely. It's this is a little bit more in depth on the HeartMath itself, using breath rate, heart rate, and heart rate variability mm-hmm. to come into a state of what they call coherence. Mm-hmm. And HeartMath is a wonderful tool. It's a great practice for those who are capable of putting in the effort that HeartMath requires. It's 15 to 20 minutes daily of practice with the device that's measuring on the ear. And mm-hmm. it's a great device. I have zero problem with the device. I think it's an actual wonderful, wonderful tool. Mm-hmm. The challenges for those who aren't capable or willing to put in the time to the practice, it's very difficult to make something just to make it as habitual as possible.
Yeah, you're right. I have a device myself, and to remember to do it is difficult, and I might just fall asleep when I do it before bed.
Exactly.
So how would somebody know that they have a vagus nerve issue going on? Like, what type of symptoms would they have, and you know, how common is that?
You've alluded to a couple of the challenges already. So number one, and most people have some sort of wearable device now, where they can monitor this, but it's heart rate elevated on a consistent basis. So a high resting heart rate is an initial sign of mm-hmm. vagus nerve not functioning well. This is important because when the vagus nerve is functioning well, it is what the signals from the vagus nerve are what reduce the heart rate to that comfortable resting heart rate level. You want to be between 50 and 70 generally for longevity and for peak health. We want to focus on getting into that 45 to 55 number, which would be a sign that you're not working too hard. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Okay, so that would be
heart rate would be one of those things.
Yeah, heart rate is an initial step. It's not the most in depth, and it's not a very accurate just to vagus nerve marker, but it's an important one to look at. The big one for me is heart rate variability. Yeah. So HRV is a measure of the amount of time between beats of the heart measured over time. So it requires a time bracket or a time measurement, so over 3 minutes, over 5 minutes, etc. Things like that. And what we're looking for is a trend where our heart is not beating like a metronome. We want variability. We want it to go from 300 milliseconds to 370 milliseconds to 420 milliseconds to 310 milliseconds, and that our heart not beat like a metronome.
Exactly.
The more variable, the more vagus nerve stimulation is occurring.
Right. So how would, I was an Oura Ring user for three, four years has a very good heart rate variability function.
Yes.
How would you, basically they always tell people to perform against yourself because, young person has a variability like 90 and mine is stuck at like 50 on a great day. But so how would you ask them? Like, what would you do? Like, so tell people, okay, if you're below what you think you normally are, then you may be in an issue where vagus nerve,
That's exactly right. So it's not an absolute measure, which means that you can't compare two people. It's going to be very different. And then different devices measure in a slightly different way. Yeah. So Oura Ring, for example, measures an average HRV through the entirety of the sleep cycle. It doesn't measure during the day unless you specifically set an unguided session to measure that. But it's again an average over that period of time. So it's not going to be what is my HRV in this exact moment. Mm-hmm. It's what is your HRV trend going to be over time. And so it's an important thing to note that you don't want to compare your 50 to somebody else's 90, right? We find that people that are athletes that have trained from a really long time, from childhood, they have this phenomenal cardiovascular capacity and VO2 max through the roof. their HRV can be 120 to 150 milliseconds, which is massive, right? Just a huge positive number.
Right.
Where people that are generally in more chronic health conditions often have very low HRV. And we're looking in the 10 to 25 to 30 category millisecond wise. So there is a very wide range, and you'd never want to compare somebody who's dealing with a chronic condition to somebody who's an athlete that's got like max VO2 max levels and stuff like that.
Right.
We can't have that comparison occur, but what we can say is, what is this person's average? What is this person's target? And what happens when they sleep well, when they eat well, when they feel well, when they feel rested? What happens to their HRV then? Do they get up into the 30, 40, 50 range? Right. And we want to compare to yourself every single day is kind of what you're looking for.
So, okay. So we've done heart rate variability. What else is, what other symptoms, what other signs could there be that there's a need, you know, for looking at the vagus nerve for them?
Yeah.
The most GI type symptoms or something.
Yeah. Yeah. So GI issues are very commonly linked to vagus nerve dysfunction. So gastroparesis, IBS, IBD, constipation, diarrhea. If it's not something that's particularly triggered by a microbiome specific issue in an acute scenario, then the vagus nerve is often involved heavily. And that's because the stimulation from the vagus nerve that goes to the gut, 80% of it is actually coming from the gut up. So it's talking from the microbiome through the vagus nerve to the brain. Mm-hmm. But the information that's going from the brain to the gut is turning on peristalsis. It's turning on that migrating motor complex to allow for food to be moved effectively through the entirety of the gut and for nutrients to be absorbed effectively. It's also heavily involved in the production of a zonulin and occludin, which are the molecules that hold our epithelial cells together. So it stops the leakiness of the gut. This has actually been proven with vagus nerve stimulation, actually improving or proactively stopping the breakdown of occurring for ultrastructure injury, mm-hmm. even when they induce colitis and things like that in animals. Mm-hmm. So really great study to show, like, it's the macrophages underneath, the 70% of immune cells in our body that are located in the gut lining are actually influenced heavily by vagus nerve, sending acetylcholine and turning on the rebuild mechanisms of those macrophages to get the gut lining to be nice and strong and functional.
Oh, wow. Okay. So you mentioned constipation, maybe IBS symptoms. Do we have any relation with IBS?
Yeah, absolutely. And specifically on the SIBO side, something that is really heavily overlooked with SIBO, we're often throwing a bunch of herbs or antibiotics at people and not having the results last. We can get short-term relief and then the issue comes back. And it's often because a neurological piece has been missed in vagus nerve function. And so we need that that neurological innervation sending a signal to the gut to say, yeah, we're not in a stressed state. We're in a calm state. We're in a parasympathetic state. Mm-hmm. Digestion can occur now. And that signal goes down and turns on that peristaltic motion. And so that allows for the bacteria that may be present in the small intestine to get pushed into the large intestine. Secondarily, the tone of your ileocecal valve is heavily linked to vagus nerve because the vagus nerve does send signals directly to the ileocecal valve. So having a backwards movement of foods from the large to the small intestine, which it shouldn't be going anyway, but the tonicity of the ileocecal valve is heavily linked to vagus nerve tone.
Mm-hmm. And you mentioned the spleen, anything specific there?
Yeah, spleen-wise, this is where kind of the understanding of the cholinergic anti-inflammatory pathway came up. Now, it's not a direct link, but it is a very important one. Mm-hmm. Vagus nerve sends a branch to the splenic ganglion, which is at a level approximately T10 of the thoracic spine. So we have the sympathetic chain that's going down on both sides of our spine at the back, but just in front of the spine. And it goes down and they have these little ganglia, which are like globules of neuron cell bodies. And that's where the connections tend to occur. The vagus nerve has a specific branch that goes to the splenic ganglion at T10 level, and it goes and it innervates this sympathetic chain. So it's a parasympathetic nerve sending acetylcholine to a sympathetic chain ganglia. So it's turning on this sympathetic ganglion at the splenic ganglion at T10, And that through the splenic ganglion is sending a nerve through the splenic, or sending a signal through the splenic nerve to the spleen. And that signal activates norepinephrine. Norepinephrine is the is a neurotransmitter of the sympathetic nervous system. Yeah. But what's happening is there's very particular cells in the initial area of the splenic ganglion, or the spleen itself, called CHAT cells. These are T lymphocytes, but they're very specific T lymphocytes. Those T lymphocytes, when they get a lot of norepinephrine coming in, become activated, and then they go and amplify the effect of the acetylcholine to the rest of the body, especially all the areas that are not innervated by vagus nerve. So this is
just basically amplifying the effect of the vagus nerve.
That's exactly it. So vagus nerve has direct innervation, sending acetylcholine to all of these organs that I talked about earlier. Yeah. But how do we get this acetylcholine sent to the muscles, to the bones, to the joints, to all of the other areas that don't have direct vagus nerve innervation? It comes through the bloodstream via these CHAT cells being turned on and becoming amplifiers for that acetylcholine.
What's the impact with food? Does food do something to this, how this nerve is stimulated?
Yeah, a lot of people are really lacking in particular nutrients when it comes to vagus nerve. And vagus nerve, I kind of just mentioned it, but the neurotransmitter that vagus nerve uses is called acetylcholine. So there's two particular parts to this. There's the acetyl-CoA and there's choline. Acetyl-CoA is a byproduct of fat and carbohydrate metabolism in the body. Right. When we lack B vitamins, B1, B3, chromium, lipoic acid, we are not going to have really effective carbohydrate metabolism. When we lack carnitine and vitamin B2, we're not going to be able to burn fats into acetyl-CoA. Those are important because those are precursors to mitochondrial function being effective.
Sure.
They're heavily involved in the production of acetyl-CoA. So when we lack B vitamins, we lack those particular nutrients, we can't build up enough acetyl-CoA for A, the mitochondria to function well, and for B, acetylcholine production. Number two is choline. And choline is deficient in about 90% of people in North America. We are deficient, heavily, heavily deficient. We need to get nutrient.
Telling my patients to take phosphatidylcholine supplements regularly for many aspects. Apart from supplements, where could they get this from? I think eggs.
Eggs are the main source, particularly yolks and runny yolks. Don't cook the yolk if you want the choline to be effective and easily bioavailable. So I'm a big fan of like soft boiled or sunny side up type eggs, because that runny yolk will contain a lot more bioavailable choline than almost any other choice. And then when it comes to supplementation, there's a few different types of choline that you could use. I'm a big fan of what you mentioned there. Phosphatidylcholine and alpha GPC being my top two.
Okay, perfect. Okay, that's great. I'll put some links in for our viewers. So let's talk now a little bit about. Okay, so I figured out. Okay, I need to like do something about my vagus nerve. There's some dysfunction going on. What are the lifestyle things one could do to address this issue? Like, you know, meditation, or we talk exercise. What can you do?
It's funny enough, it's all the basics, but most importantly, the key is breath. Breath is the one major controlling piece that we have to shift our state from sympathetic to parasympathetic, to go from activated and stressed and fight or flight to less activated, rest, digest, recover, and restore mode. So we often think parasympathetic just means rest and digest. I've added the recover and restore pieces in there, because that's where, after a major stressor, after a challenge, or after a competition, for example, we need to recover. And that can only happen when we get into parasympathetic state. The breath is the key here. So fast breath is a sign of sympathetic activation. Chest breathing is a sign of sympathetic activation. And mouth breathing is a sign of sympathetic activation. So if we're breathing through our mouth and we're breathing shallow with our chest and our upper back muscles, and we're breathing short and shallow, that's a sign to our brain that we are under stress, that there is some threat to our survival potentially happening. This has been around for thousands of years as something that we've adapted. Now, with all the stressors that we experience, more people than ever are breathing poorly. They're breathing with their chest. They're breathing with their upper back muscles. They're breathing with their mouth. All of the challenges of metabolism and whatnot are absolutely contributing to a poor ability to breathe effectively. And we've often forgotten how to breathe using our diaphragm.
Yeah. So diaphragm is innervated by the vagus nerve too, I
see. It's not innervated by the vagus nerve. It's the phrenic nerve diaphragm directly, but the vagus nerve goes through the diaphragm to get to the abdomen. Okay. It's not a motor nerve there. It's often mistaken, but it is the phrenic nerve that goes to diaphragm.
So as our viewers are just listening to this, I mean, they should just take a breath and just see if you can breathe through your stomach. What does that feel like?
Yeah. So one of the tools that I use with all my patients, hand on the chest, hand on the belly at the same time, take a deep breath and check which hand is moving. Ideally, the hand that's on your chest should not be moving almost at all. It should be just the hand that's on the belly, allowing for an inflation to be occurring below. When we breathe with our diaphragm, what's actually happening is we're creating a vacuum in our chest, allowing for air to be sucked into the lungs. Mm-hmm. But what's happening with that diaphragm, when it goes down, it's actually massaging the gut as well. Mm-hmm. And that's creating motion pattern in the abdominal organ. So the liver, the small intestine, the stomach get a physical motion pattern signaling that we're in a parasympathetic state, signaling digestion to turn on.
Right.
So it's a great way to kind of counterbalance it with a physical motion pattern that activates the parasympathetic nervous system.
Perfect. Okay. So we have breathing, you said, and you know, people talk about, so basically slowing down breathing and abdominal breathing is what you're saying. But there's no like special like formula, like, you know, take a breath in for 4 seconds, hold for 4 seconds.
There are some that you can use. Box breathing is a great option. 4-4-4-4.
Yeah.
The one that I've found to be really effective is 4-7-8, in particular because while we're inhaling, we're actually stimulating our sympathetics a little bit more. Our heart rate actually rises when we inhale. As we exhale, the heart rate comes down. So if we lengthen the exhale to more than the inhale, it's going to trigger parasympathetic activity.
Right.
Slowing down breath rate and slowing down the exhale time over the inhale time will absolutely shift you towards a vagally activated tone. So 4 seconds in, 7 second hold, 8 seconds out is a great pattern that I've found to have wonderful effects for a lot.
And after the exhale, is there any benefit to holding further? I guess that
doesn't have to be. It's really just about slowing down. You want to essentially get your breath rate below 10 per second or 10 breaths per minute. Excuse me.
Okay. Awesome. Thank you so much. This is great. So let's now move on to, you know, the company you founded. Is that, am I correct to say that?
I'm not the founder at all. In fact, I found them, but I didn't.
Oh, you found them. Okay, perfect.
Found me. So funny enough, when I wrote my book about 4 years ago, I was doing research on electrical stimulation. I just kind of briefly mentioned that electrical stimulation has shown some positive things and there's some FDA clearances for migraines and cluster headaches. And I reached out to the company. Nobody got back to me at that point. A year and a half ago, they reached out to me and said, hey, we've been using your book as a training tool for all of our sales staff because everybody needs to teach the doctors about vagus nerve.
Yeah.
And I became kind of a support mechanism for helping them teach people what the vagus nerve was. And then I started using the devices with some of my patients and for myself. And vagus nerve stimulation has just exploded what we're capable of helping people with in inflammatory conditions or even just in terms of optimization, which is really exciting, but really focusing on improving the function of this nerve because for too many people, that nerve function is just deteriorated to the point where they need external support. And if we can avoid doing it with pharmaceuticals and do something with a non-invasive tool that's going to not have any major side effects at all, this is a wonderful piece that people can add into their lives.
So maybe if you could just kind of show the device, because I mean, getting people's head around that you have to how to stimulate an actual nerve.
Yeah. So this is the GammaCore Sapphire device. They have a few other options, but this is the one that I use clinically with most of my patients. It's two electrodes that are sitting on the top of it. I kind of mentioned this earlier, but anatomically, when you find your pulse, you're looking for your carotid artery. If you find your pulse, you found your vagus nerve. So what you're doing is you're going to that point, you're turning on the device, and then you're increasing the intensity of the device with an electrical stimulation. This device and the therapy that's being provided, patented by this company, is a very high frequency. It's a 5,000 hertz frequency. It's not a microcurrent. It's not a TENS. So it doesn't activate the pain fibers. It actually doesn't turn on the C fibers of the vagus nerve. It's only shown to activate the A delta fibers, which are the afferent fibers going up to the brainstem. So we're getting essentially a massive electrical stimulation into the NTS and the other three nuclei of the brainstem of the vagus nerve. So we get this vagus nerve brainstem activation that tells us that we're in a parasympathetic state. That sends signals up into the brain to calm inflammation, to create some neuromodulation. It really does help improve your serotonin and dopamine, but in particular, your acetylcholine levels, which is obviously really important on microglial activity. And then on the way down on the efferent, it's going to send out acetylcholine through those pathways as well. So it really stimulates through and almost supercharging the vagus nerve to do its work below and to send signals up into the brain to have really positive effects.
So I just wanted to rewind a little bit for our viewers. So it's a little device that you're going to put over here. It's like it's a stimulation, a kind of electrical stimulation. Yeah. And do they feel anything?
Yeah, you'll feel a bit of a tingle. It's absolutely something that you can set the intensity of. So it doesn't trigger any painful response. And it also does depend on just how much pressure you're putting, but you're not going to get a pain response. You will get a muscle twitching, a muscle pull. You might get a little pull on your lip. That's actually a really good sign that you've hit the right spot. Okay. The platysma muscle is kind of overlying on the entirety of the neck. So when you hit this, you have to go through that muscle to get that activity. So you'll often get a bit of a pull, but it's not painful. And then if you hit the right spot, then you'll get a pull on your lip.
And you're saying it's a type of the electrical stimulation different than, let's say, Dr. Ho's machine or a TENS.
Oh, absolutely machine. Not the same as Dr. Ho's.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Okay, that sounds good. So how many times a day are they supposed to do it, and you know, how long?
Depends on the clinical presentation, but my basic rule of thumb is 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes in the evening.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Oh, so it's only 4 minutes.
Yeah, it's 2 minutes in the morning, 2 minutes in the evening. It's so easy to add into a daily life, and that's why I really am an advocate for this, because with such a small amount of actual time invested into making this happen, you keep it on your bedside table. You wake up in the morning and stimulate. You wake right before you go to bed. You stimulate for 2 minutes and you go to sleep. We're finding phenomenal results in people's sleep changes, phenomenal results in their energy through the day. Mm-hmm. Just it almost sounds like snake oil, but in reality, I'm getting
it's hard to believe.
Phenomenal results. It is hard to believe, and yeah, that's exactly part of the magic behind it. Is this is proven through research. Time and time again, there's about 80 different published studies over the last 15 years on this particular device or precursors to this device that have had phenomenal results in various conditions.
Let's say if somebody has, like, you know, panic attacks or something, like anxiety is so common, and that's probably sympathetic overdrive. Do you think have you seen results with this type of device?
Yeah, this is one of the areas that's kind of the bread and butter of this device is anxiety and sleep. So sleep improvements or sleep changes we know are heavily linked to mental health disorders, whether it's depression or anxiety. We know that there's changes to sleep patterns, waking time, sleep time is going to vary quite a bit. When we can create normalization within the sleep pattern, then we're allowing for balance within the neurotransmitters to occur in the brain. And so what we have is a reduction in norepinephrine and some of the more activating glutamate type of excitation that can occur, and a lowering or support of the serotonin and dopamine levels.
Okay, that makes sense. Okay, and then can you tell us where can one get this device? What's it called?
Yeah, absolutely. The Gammacore Sapphire, the one that I'm holding right here, is a clinical device. So you would have to get this prescription-wise from a practitioner.
Okay.
There are other options within the company. The one that you have been
made. Yeah, I have one right here.
True Vega.
Right, there's the
True Vega device.
True Vega device, yeah. Which is more consumer device. Is that correct?
Exactly. That is a consumer device. So that is available for purchase over the counter from the company itself, truevega.com.
Yeah.
And it's just an easy, simple add-on. It is. There's not a rechargeable device, so you use it up, and then once it's done, the device is essentially waste, I guess. So
it has a certain number of treatments. Is that correct?
It has 350 stimulations on that particular device. Yes.
Okay, then you can't recharge it. Whereas the ElectroCore, you could.
Yeah, the GammaCore Sapphire comes with a full charging pack, and it's something that you just recharge with your practitioner on an ongoing basis. It's a very therapeutic approach. So it's kind of we recommend a 3-month prescription or something along those lines.
Is it covered by any insurance companies that use buy this device?
Not in the US that I'm aware of, and absolutely not in Canada because we're in Canada. So it is not covered, but it's something that has had such phenomenal results that I think it's absolutely worth every penny for the people that need it.
Well, that's really amazing. Anything else you kind of want to tell us a little bit about this?
Yeah, I can, absolutely. Because I know you come from a bit of a biohacking side of things as well. And we actually met at the biohacking conference in Toronto, if you remember, years and years ago.
2017.
Yes. Pre-pandemic, pre-chaos. The really cool thing that's coming up here is there was a research study that just came out with this particular device that was utilized by the Air Force in the Defense Language Learning Institute. Mm-hmm. And the results are essentially astounding. When they had two groups of people that were learning a second language, and this is like CIA spies and Air Force people that are learning a second language so they can communicate with people. And what was shown was using the device, they can speed up language learning by 25%, recall and language learning by 25%. So instead of 4 days, it was taking 3 days.
So they were doing it again twice a day, 2 minutes?
They were doing before the learning and after the learning.
Oh, okay.
Specifically, so they were adding it in there, but it was pre-lesson, post-lesson, and then the recall points 4 days and 8 days and 16 days later were amazing.
So do you feel like this is more like a lifestyle treatment? Just like, you know, we have other lifestyle drugs that people are taking with, you know, they don't necessarily have an illness, but they just want to be at their peak performance.
Yeah.
Are you seeing that's where this could be going?
When it comes to neuroplasticity, we're learning more and more that it's not the neurons that drive neuroplasticity, it's the microglia, right? And the microglia are the macrophages of the brain. And when these macrophages are in a state of hyperinflammatory, hyper-challenging kind of state, essentially you're calling in the firefighters. The firefighters are there to put out every fire. They want to stop any threats to their survival. What happens when you stimulate the vagus nerve, when you trigger acetylcholine production within the brain, you shift these microglia cells from M1 activated firefighter types into the repairmen and the housekeepers and the ones that maintain neuroplasticity and homeostasis. And so what happens is we have stronger forming connections and more rebuild repair occurring within the microglia and overall within the brain. So it leads to cognitive improvements. It leads to improvements in energy. Yeah. It leads to improvements in neuroplasticity. It speeds up how fast people can remember things or keep things in their mind. And because of that, it's improving sleep. And because it's improving sleep, then the recall and the memory are improving as well.
A couple of things I would jump on there. So it's improving sleep. Do we know what aspects of sleep, deep sleep, REM sleep?
Doesn't say specifically. It has to do with waking. So less waking cycles. Yes. So we're staying asleep longer is more commonly the issue.
Yes.
And I'm finding with my patients, and this is obviously very theoretical, very clinical findings, deep sleep is slightly elevated.
I think because it's basically depressing the arousal. I mean, we think that sleep isn't really a problem of arousal.
Exactly.
Of the nervous system. And then this, you just really piqued my interest. I have a particular interest in brain health and all about Alzheimer's. And so what do you think about that? And if you're saying that there could be cognitive improvements, do you think there could be some impact on such a neurodegenerative diseases?
Absolutely. So I'll give you a clinical story from my, I have a group that I run, Vagus Nerve Upgrade Program. Yeah. And one of my clients that came in has Parkinson's, diagnosed about 15 years ago. Tremor has been there forever. One of the first symptoms of his Parkinson's was anosmia. He lost his sense of smell. So 18 years ago, he essentially stopped being able to smell anything. Started using the device for 2 weeks. On the second week, he messaged and he said, "For the first time in 18 years, I can smell my wife cooking bacon downstairs."
Wow.
A ridiculous story. And then literally the hour before we're getting on this call, I was on another one. I have a patient who was considered nearly legally blind, 20/100 vision. So getting down that path. And she no longer has to walk around with her her cane to ensure that she's safe. Her vision improves
significantly. That's crazy, almost out of science fiction. Yeah. That's pretty amazing. What about like for athletes who, you know, they want to, do you think there'd be some benefit there?
I'm thinking about what the best way to share this is. I can't share names of specific athletes.
Yeah.
But know that championships have been won with people that are using these tools, very well-known championships. And one of the best applications for it is post-concussion TBI.
Right.
It is phenomenal at reducing the spread of the inflammatory reaction within the brain, reducing amounts of damage that have occurred. Just vagus nerve stimulation in general is really good at reducing the risk of major TBI-based events.
Is there studies that actually show, like, okay, when you apply this device, that you know the nerve, vagus nerve, is stimulated? Like, is there how do they test for that?
It was fMRI that was done. So they essentially, this device is the easiest, shortest duration, but they wanted to compare it to auricular stimulation. So there's electrical stimulation of the tragus, which is auricular branch. And then there's actual invasive where they actually go in, coil around the vagus nerve and put a device inside. That was where this whole kind of pathway began, was epileptic patients needed something to help reduce seizures, and that's what vagus nerve stim is really great for. So an fMRI study was done comparing non-invasive electrical vagus nerve stimulation versus auricular versus implanted. And the fMRI study showed that within 2 minutes, we had the same amount of activation in the brainstem, particularly the NTS, neuronucleus tractus solitarius, which is the main parasympathetic nuclei in the brainstem, getting that activation. So it's very, very well researched. There's research coming out of Johns Hopkins and MGH and Stanford and you name it, all of these.
So before this device, how did people do this? They were not able to do this, or was there like, it had to be happen? How were they doing in the research area? They would have to like put an electrode or something like right on.
Yeah, implanted was the way to go.
Right. So this is really, this is a huge game changer. And this has become so much more easier for anybody to just stimulate their vagus nerve and
100%
part of their lifestyle.
100%.
Wow. Okay. I think this is amazing. I hope the viewers enjoyed this. Again, it's Dr. Habib is here from Health Upgraded. He's got his own podcast called the Health Upgrade Podcast. Go subscribe on his channel if you liked what he's saying and learn more about that. And if you like what we're doing here, then subscribe to this podcast. That'd be great. Thanks so much, Navaz. I really appreciate your time today.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
All right. Okay. Talk soon.